The National Black Law Students Association, NABLSA, a national organization founded in 1968 with the purpose of increasing the number of culturally responsible Black and minority attorneys.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and you're listening to Simone Yap. She's the immediate past national chair and CEO of the National Black Law Student Association. And she's sharing part of a letter the organization sent to the Senate Confirmation Committee in support of Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Who excel academically, succeed professionally, and positively impact the community, strongly urges and calls for the swift, intentional, and deliberate confirmation of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court.
That the emerging lawyers of the National Black Law Student Association were compelled to make their voices heard during this process is a sign of the intergenerational meaning of Jackson's nomination.
On this vote, the yeas are 53, the nays are 47, and this nomination is confirmed.
Earlier this week, the Senate confirmed Judge Jackson's nomination, making her the newest Associate Justice and the first Black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court.
And this nomination is confirmed.
All right. Okay. Congratulations.
And while the future is looking toward Justice Jackson, she took time during her opening statement of her confirmation hearings to acknowledge the past.
I stand on the shoulders of so many who have come before me, including Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman to be appointed to the federal bench and with whom I share a birthday. And like Judge Motley, I have dedicated my career to ensuring that the words engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building, "Equal Justice Under Law," are a reality and not just an ideal.
So this seemed like the right time to take a deep dive into the life and legacy of the woman on whose shoulders Justice Jackson says she stands, Constance Baker Motley.
Do you, Constance Baker Motley, solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of New York, and that you will faithfully discharge the duties of the office of President of the Borough of Manhattan of the City of New York according to the best of your ability?
I do.
Now, y'all know the deal. A deep dive means I'm joined by my friend, colleague, and deep dive partner, Dorian Warren, who's co-president of Community Change and co-chair of the Economic Security Project. Dorian, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa. It's always great to join the team here on The Takeaway. And today's deep dive is just such a fascinating one because Constance Baker Motley is a towering figure in law, in politics, and in social justice. Born in 1921, the ninth of 12 children, Motley grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, living in the literal and figurative shadow of my graduate school alma mater, Yale University. Now, as the child of working-class West Indian immigrant parents, she didn't have the financial resources to consider an Ivy League education. But because her father worked as a staff member in the university's eating clubs, he enjoyed an unequal yet intimate familiarity with the wealthy white men who attended Yale. Young Constance grew up with an insider's view into the elite institution, even as she was peeking in through the back door to get that view. And as a girl, she harbored dreams of attending college and becoming a lawyer.
Which were pretty audacious dreams for a Black girl in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm, and I'm not sure she would have called herself audacious, but she had a strict upbringing that focused on excellence, but also emphasized respect and rule following. And back in 2002, Constance Baker Motley spoke with an oral history archival effort called the National Visionary Leaders Project. Here's what she had to say when asked if she had been a mischievous child.
Gee, that's hard to say. Because mischievous children were not permitted in our house. You were told to sit down and read a book or sit down and be quiet. And that was it. And my mother would say to us, wait till your father comes home.
All right, so maybe she followed the rules, But she also stood out from the crowd. I mean, Dorian, when she was just 18 years old, Constance Baker delivered a speech at the local African-American social club. The club's sponsor was a wealthy white philanthropist named Clarence Blakesley. And he was so impressed by Constance, he offered to pay for her college education. She started at Fisk University, a historically black college in Nashville, Tennessee. And that trip to campus was her first experience with the demeaning limitations of the Jim Crow South. Here again, she speaks to the National Visionary Leaders Project in 2002.
Well, I had to change trains in Cincinnati and get on a Jim Crow car. Well, I knew that was going to happen, of course. Everybody knew that happened to black people. So, you know, it's just that when that happened to me, I did realize this is for real segregation.
She stayed for just over a year at Fisk, but then returned north and finished her college education, graduating from NYU in 1943. Baker then enrolled at Columbia University School of Law. It was a moment when many young men were departing for World War II, and by leaving, they opened space for women to be seated in law school classrooms for the first time.
Yeah, Melissa, she was classmates with Bella Abzug, famous first, in terms of New York City politics and gender. She preceded future Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg by over a decade. And it was during this time at Columbia Law School that she met Thurgood Marshall. Here again is Motley speaking in the 2002 interview with the National Visionary Leaders Project.
Herman Taylor was there, a black young man. One of his three jobs was clerking for Thurgood Marshall. So when he got ready to graduate, he said to me, "Don't you want this job that I have with Thurgood Marshall?" I said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Well, go on down, you know, and see him," which I did. And of course, that's how I got the job.
I mean, she's just so casual with it. Like, "Oh, yeah, I just popped on down and got a job with Thurgood Marshall." And Dorian, the truly wild part is that this incredible story is barely even the first half of the first chapter of the life of Constance Baker Motley. What she then goes on to accomplish and who she becomes in the following decades, well, those are the years, and that is the story that makes her the giant who hoists Ketanji Brown Jackson onto her shoulders.
It's a story told with grace and insight by our guest, Tamiko Brown Nagin. She is dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, a professor of law and professor of history at Harvard University, and author of Civil Rights Queen: Constance Baker Motley and the Struggle for Equality. Professor Brown Nagin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
What were some of her first cases?
Constance Baker Motley's first case was in Jackson, Mississippi, where she argued on behalf of African-American school teachers who were subject to pay disparities, no matter how experienced they were, no matter how qualified they were, the black teachers were paid less than white ones. And Motley shows up in Jackson with her colleague, Bob Carter, and she appears in the courtroom and just causes a sensation, both in the black community and among whites. For blacks, she was the Negro woman lawyer from New York. She was nothing short of a savior who was coming to Jackson to challenge white supremacy. And as you can imagine, for whites, she was quite transgressive. Both of them were to stand up in the courthouse and ask questions of white people, asking them to defend their actions, to explain themselves. This has just never been done before. And so she created a stir, and it was the start of a career where she continually challenged white supremacy. She was known as a great cross-examiner, and the people she was cross-examining were members of the white power structure. And there are many cases, including several in education, that changed the legal architecture of this country for Ketanji Brown Jackson and so many of us.
It's 4 or 5 years later that Constance Baker Motley is the only woman on the legal team of Brown v. Board of Education. Can you talk to us about what role she played in this historic case?
Well, in a real way, Brown versus Board of Education was her intellectual handiwork because she wrote the original complaint in the cases. Then she went on to conduct legal research for the briefs that were submitted by the Inc. Fund to the U.S. Supreme Court. And she also did quite a lot of grunt work. So she was vital to Brown versus Board of Education. Although, as I point out in my book, she did not argue one of the cases at the Supreme Court. It was quite a decision-making calculus for Thurgood Marshall to decide who argued. Motley did not argue. And the background for that decision, I believe, lies in the reality that even as she was doing all of this work in support of Brown versus Board of Education, Motley was pregnant. She had her first child, and then she was the mother of a young son, doing everything that the men did, but also caring for her child, which just illustrates what a phenomenal person she was.
Talk to us a bit about the fact that Baker Motley was the first Black woman to argue a case before the Supreme Court.
She was nervous the night before. After all, it's a big deal to appear before the justices. She was arguing for the principle that the criminal defendant in question was entitled to an attorney during arraignment. The case involved a classic and sad setup from the Jim Crow South, where an African-American man had been charged with ravishing a white woman and had not been entitled to very much of a defense at all. And so Motley ended up in her first oral argument before the Supreme Court, saving this person's life. And so it was a tremendous moment for her and the first of 10 appearances before the U.S. Supreme Court. She won 9 of the cases that she argued before the justices. We just haven't heard very much about this before. Instead, we've heard about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's record at the Supreme Court, and certainly we should have, but I would note that Motley argued more cases than Ginsburg, came before Ginsburg, and yet just hasn't gotten the recognition that she deserves. And so for that reason, I am delighted to send this book out into the world so that more Americans can know about the great Constance Baker Motley and her struggles.
Now, Professor, can you tell us what led Motley to seek elected office?
Sure. Well, she sought elective office because Democrats in New York could see that she would be a great asset. And so a number of people came to her, asking her, inviting her to stand for office. After all, she had name recognition because of her exploits in the courtroom on behalf of the Inc. Fund. She was one of the most famous lawyers in America after litigating the Meredith case in particular. And so she was invited to stand for election to the New York Senate, the first Black woman to that body. And she went on to be asked to run for Manhattan Borough president, which was a big job, both symbolically important and substantively important, because the Manhattan Borough president had a hand in shaping the budget of New York City. And she ended up prevailing, becoming Manhattan Borough president. She was the first woman to occupy that office. And I should note that there were quite a few people who were not happy that she was elected. They thought that the civil rights lawyer should stay in her own lane. And some of the people who had this perception of her and her place included Malcolm X, Adam Clayton Powell Jr. This was in the context of a rise of Black power, where Motley to some looked a little passé because, of course, she was a standard bearer for integration, which many people were questioning as a path to Black empowerment by that time.
Can you talk a little bit about her influence, but also specifically the gendered politics here? And really, how did Black male political leadership receive her in this role?
Leadership itself was coded male, was equated with being a man. And this was true in the Black freedom struggle, no less than in wider society. To be a leader was to be a charismatic figure, to be owning the room. And Motley was not like that. She was more reserved. She was lawyerly. And she was a woman. And there were those who just had difficulty seeing her in such important roles. And yet, it was thought at the time by her backers that she might be the first Black mayor of New York City. And so, like it or not, she did pave the way for some of the figures who came after her. And it is notable that, as you mentioned, in this entirely different realm, she was able to make history and have impact. She overlapped with Shirley Chisholm in the New York legislature, by the way. They were great friends. And so the impact was for African-Americans writ large, but also for women like Shirley Chisholm and also Bella Abzug, who becomes the first woman elected to Congress from New York.
She then makes yet another turn. She leaves politics, returns to law because she's nominated to the federal bench by President Johnson, who, of course, also nominated Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. Can you talk a bit about what kind of jurist she was? What were some of her accomplishments on the bench?
Sure. Well, when Motley was appointed to the bench, the civil rights and women's rights movements were delighted. They were ecstatic, thinking having one of their own on the bench would result in the validation of the progressive claims of these movements. And to an extent, and in several cases, that idea was borne out. Motley decided a case on behalf of sports journalist Melissa Lucky, who was excluded from the clubhouse of New York Yankees during the World Series. And sued, saying that that kind of sex discrimination was unconstitutional. She prevailed with Motley presiding in the case. Well, Motley didn't know anything about sports and wasn't really trying to find out a lot about sports, but she knew that the blanket exclusion of women from a profession was a violation of the law. She ruled in that case. It was very controversial and a very important case. Another case that she ruled in was on behalf of Martin Sostre, who was a jailhouse lawyer, a Black Panther, a freedom fighter on behalf of incarcerated individuals who sued when he was relegated to solitary confinement for months at a time. He asked for damages and Constance Baker Motley awarded them, saying that solitary confinement was cruel and unusual punishment. This was an amazing case that was deeply controversial. Let's say law enforcement was unfavorable as to Motley's ruling in this case, and it was brave of her to rule in that way. And then there were other cases where she didn't always validate the claims of the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement. This was largely because she was constrained as a trial court judge, but also there's a lot that goes into whether a plaintiff is able to prevail in a case. And so Motley was, as I say in the book, she was certainly a political liberal, but more of a judicial pragmatist.
All right. Now, for both of y'all, I feel like before we go any further, I should confess something, because I did let this book just kind of sit on my shelf for nearly 2 months before I started reading it, because I just could not open it.
It is 500 pages long and weighs at least 5 pounds. I'm just saying a decade of work went into this book.
No doubt. But I will say I'm not afraid of a ginormous book. That wasn't it. It was actually because I kind of thought the book might be a historical hit piece.
Why do you say that, Melissa? What makes you go there?
It's the title, Civil Rights Queen. I just kept thinking of how describing a Black woman as a queen has typically been a slur in American politics.
So, you know, for instance, like Ronald Reagan's 1976 presidential campaign that introduced Linda Taylor, who would become known as the Welfare Queen. Is that what you mean?
In Chicago, they found a woman who holds the record. She used 80 names, 30 addresses, 15 telephone numbers, to collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans benefits for four non-existent deceased veterans' husbands, as well as welfare.
And while Linda Taylor was a real person, the massive defrauding of the American welfare system by black women is a wholesale myth.
Queen was deployed against the late Professor Lonnie Guinier in a very similar way. In 1993, President Bill Clinton had nominated Guinier to lead the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, but conservative thinkers offered these kind of bad faith misreadings of her academic writing and designated her a quota queen. So President Clinton withdrew her nomination before she even had the opportunity to appear before the Senate Confirmation Committee. Let's listen to Professor Guinier speaking to the Today Show's Bryant Gumbel back in 1993.
What are you feeling this morning? I'm sure disappointment is a part of the equation, but are you feeling angry? Betrayed? Hurt? What?
To tell you the truth, I'm feeling very tired, but in addition, very frustrated that, in my case, the political process has not worked.
So I hear you, Melissa. When you think of welfare queen or quota queen, I kept fearing that one of the Republican senators badgering Jackson last month might go too far and refer to her as sort of like a child porn queen.
It felt like implied. And it's as though it's laughable, even impossible to imagine a black woman actually reigning over something valuable and worthy. So when I saw the title, Civil Rights Queen, I cringed. But Professor Brown-Nagin's text teaches us that Civil Rights Queen was very much a term of reverence and respect. So Professor Brown-Nagin, who is still with us, will you help us to understand where that phrase came from? How did Motley come to be described as the Civil Rights Queen?
It was definitely a term of honor, one that captured her singularity. A few people had seen a black lawyer or a woman lawyer, and Motley was this incredible combination of a black woman lawyer. The title Civil Rights Queen was given to her by a black journalist. It was meant to evoke how she wielded the law as sort of a sword of justice. She stood nearly 6 feet tall. She commanded the room. It is meant to be transgressive. So Motley could have been the first black woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. She was touted for that role, but she couldn't get there because her background as a civil rights lawyer was weaponized against her. Her race was, her gender was. I mean, to both honor her, but also to call attention to her reality, and I'm very much taking Queen back from those who would denigrate black women.
This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson speaking to her daughters during her Senate confirmation hearings in March.
Girls, I know it has not been easy as I've tried to navigate the challenges of juggling my career and motherhood. And I fully admit that I did not always get the balance right. But I hope that you've seen that with hard work, determination, and love, it can be done.
Ooh, so Melissa, I was thinking about you because I know that as a hardworking mama of two daughters, I just know you felt this moment.
Oh, you know I did. And not just personally, I mean, it was fraught with so much meaning, not only for all working moms, but especially for black mamas. Because we face such a long and bitter history of being maligned. I mean, think of enslaved black women who were treated as though they were just producing units for sale. Or think of all the ways social and cultural messages suggest black women's reproduction is rampant and irresponsible, of the black mamas forced to submit to involuntary sterilization or pressured by public policy into using long-term birth control.
And during our takeaway deep dive about childbirth back in December, we talked with researchers who told us that black women are nearly three times as likely as their white counterparts to die as a result of pregnancy complications. So yes, black motherhood is both personal and political.
Which, of course, brings us back to Constance Baker Motley, who gave birth to her only son, Joel, in the midst of serving as the sole woman on the legal team that secured victory in Brown v. Board of Education. And what this means is that most of Motley's long career in law and politics was spent juggling both professional duties and the responsibilities of being partner to her husband and parent to her child. Professor Tomiko Brown-Nagin, our guest, hosted a conversation with Motley's son, Joel, during an event at Harvard Law School back in 2016. Here's a bit of how he remembered his mom.
She was very funny. She was fierce. She was a fighter in a very, very tough struggle. And so she had all of the sense of organization and mission that you find in anybody who's doing something really heavy and scary. And she was very warm. She's a great mother. She was fun to be around, and it all kind of worked out.
So, Professor Brown-Nagin, we heard Motley's adult son saying it all kind of worked out. But talk to us about what were some of the challenges that Motley faced as a superstar professional and mother at the same time?
The challenges were that she had to, as a lawyer litigating cases across the country, she had to leave her child sometimes to do her job. And so I describe how one approach was to take the family with her, which resulted in one set of complications. And another approach was to leave them behind. And one would find her doing things like at the end of her trials, she would go to the office of the courthouse and ask to use the phone. And she would call back to her New York apartment and speak to her husband and her son. She had to contend with how she was transgressing a mother's role. So she had an uneasy relationship with traditional motherhood. And then what about who actually was taking care of her child? Well, her husband, Joel, was a co-parent well before that was a thing. And she also was vocal to women that if they could afford it, they should hire help. And yet I will tell you that one of the things that was heartbreaking to me to discover about Motley was that towards the end of her life, when a journalist asked her what was her greatest achievement, she said it was her son who came out well, although his mother was often not at home. And so there's that sense of pride coupled with regret, the same sentiment that Jackson expressed during her opening statement.
Professor Tomiko Brown-Nagin, author of Civil Rights Queen, thank you for writing a book that brings us such a history and such a humanity. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I've been delighted to talk to you about my book.
And everybody, stick with us. We're continuing our deep dive next as we discuss the NAACP Legal Defense Fund with the woman who now leads the storied organization where Motley began her career. This is The Takeaway.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is The Takeaway with Melissa Harris-Perry from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
We're spending the hour discussing the life, legacy, and impact of Constance Baker Motley as we mark Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation to the Supreme Court. It was a moment too long in coming. I mean, of all the people who've ever served as federal judges, fewer than 2% have been Black women. Think about that. The first, of course, was Constance Baker Motley, who was nominated to the bench by President Lyndon Johnson in 1966.
But earlier in her career, before that historic nomination, Motley was passed over for a different position of leadership. In 1961, President Kennedy nominated Thurgood Marshall to the U.S. Court of Appeals in Manhattan. Marshall's departure meant leadership of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, better known as LDF, would transition for the first time. Motley, who'd been with LDF since finishing law school 15 years earlier, was poised to assume the top spot
But instead, Thurgood Marshall named Jack Greenberg as his successor. That said, for much of the last decade, the NAACP LDF has been a woman-led organization. Elaine Jones was at the helm from 93 to 2004. From 2013 until 2022, Sherilyn Ifill set the course. And earlier this year, Janae Nelson became the LDF's 8th president and director council, marking the first time in the organization's history that the LDF leadership baton was passed from one Black woman to another. Welcome to The Takeaway, President Janae Nelson. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much, Melissa.
So the women who are currently part of the LDF, do you all talk about Constance Baker Motley?
Absolutely. Constance Baker Motley is a North Star for so many of us at the Legal Defense Fund, and not just women. All of our staff recognize the iconic and legendary trailblazing attorney that she was, and she continues to guide our thinking, and she is just one of the many in the pantheon of excellent lawyers that the Legal Defense Fund has produced.
Obviously there is that pantheon, so when you think about Motley, what is the key legacy that she left at LDF?
Well, she was an amazing lawyer who was well-trained, went to Columbia Law School, came from very humble beginnings, and grew up on the East Coast, but connected so deeply with Southern communities and individuals in the South, and young people in the South in particular. She represented students who were integrating schools, both at the higher education level, and also students who were protesting against civil rights violations. And many people don't know that she was one of the primary architects of the legal strategy for LDF's seminal Brown versus Board of Education litigation, which ended state-sponsored segregation of public schools. And she litigated multitudes of cases, including public accommodations cases, jury discrimination claims. She defended protesters, including Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy and Bernard Lafayette and Andy Young, so many of the prominent men of the movement. And she also litigated voting rights cases, which is a little known fact. She was just an all-around amazing lawyer who had a breadth and depth of expertise that, you know, you rarely see.
So, Janae, as you know, this in the midst of this debate over critical race theory in public school classrooms, it's brought to light the importance of telling, of course, the whole truth about our history. So I do want to ask a question about LDF and Motley's time during, working for Thurgood Marshall, where she had to advocate for equity and pay and entitlement and opportunity. So can you talk to us about how LDF contends with some of your own history relative to gender equity and particularly Constance Baker Motley?
Well, LDF is a product of its time. And at the time in 1940, we know that there was, which is the year we were founded, we know that there was widespread gender inequity on issues of pay and on a number of issues. And over time, what we've done is to ensure that we have created a workplace that is welcoming to all, that has a generous parental leave policy, that engages in equity analyses. We've learned from our history, and we've certainly learned from the work that we do to advance racial equity and advance gender equity. Many people are surprised when we say that one of the first Title VII cases that the Legal Defense Fund brought was on behalf of a white woman who was a mother and could not work because her employer said that she should be staying home taking care of her kids. Her name was Ida Phillips, and we fought on her behalf to ensure that all women, regardless of race, have an opportunity to work in the workplace, even if they are parents, even if they are caregivers. And that was just one of the fundamental building blocks of our employment discrimination docket, and it's something that we're quite proud of.
At last count, there are now 28 Black women law school deans, which is a record number. Do you have a message for young Black women who are studying law or just beginning their legal careers?
You look at the amazing contributions of Black jurists like Constance Baker Motley. We should take from that lesson the notion that you can shape this profession in powerful ways, that if you don't see yourself in a place you want to be, that's your opportunity to chart a path and to break that ceiling. And it is just a beautiful thing to see so many leaders in the academy, because they are the ones who are helping to shape the curriculum, helping to shape the practice ethos for a new generation of Black lawyers and of all lawyers. And I look forward to seeing what their imprint might be on the profession at large. So I think it's very encouraging. And Ketanji Brown Jackson's example is another one where she's the first, and she had to believe that she could break that glass ceiling of race and gender and the intersection of the two at the highest court in our land. And she is poised to do just that.
Jhené Nelson, President and Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, thank you for joining us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Motley was well aware of her iconic status. Here she is 20 years ago speaking with the National Visionary Leadership Project.
I know that there are many young Blacks who view me as a kind of role model. I am aware of that.
And you're glad about that?
Of course.
I'm sure Judge Motley would have loved our next guest.
My name is Simone Yap. I served as the 55th National Chair and Chief Executive Officer of the National Black Law Students Association.
Simone is an alum of Howard University and she'll be graduating next month from Northeastern School of Law, where she served on Law Review. As the immediate past president of the National Black Law Student Association, she told us a bit about why the organization was founded back in 1968, a time when African Americans were just beginning to gain access to legal education.
Once we were allowed to, we knew that we needed to have an organization that could speak to our needs as well as advocate for us. And that's how BALSA at first at NYU was formed and then transcended into a national organization with over 300 plus chapters, more than 6,000 plus active members, and a community of over 10,000 individuals.
Now, despite the significant gains in recent decades, according to data from the American Bar Association, Black students are still, quote, consistently and dramatically underrepresented in law school classrooms, which is part of the reason why the National Black Law Students Association's annual mock trial competition is named for Constance Baker Motley.
Thinking about her autobiography that she wrote and really advocating for all people, but especially Black people, and for our members who are current law students, but especially Black law students, providing that venue for them to serve in her spirit and engage in her spirit. So be zealous advocates to analyze an issue at the highest legal level and truly be a star, but also be confident in your skills, be confident in your knowledge, and execute to the highest ability, knowing that yeah, you're here, and also be confident in the fact that you belong. You're meant to be here and you have the skills to be here.
You belong here. It seems obvious, but many Black law students find their experiences tell them something quite different. Here is third-year law student Brooklyn Crockton in a TikTok she posted back in March about what happened when she arrived at court to serve as a Rule 9 attorney representing an indigent client.
He physically puts his body in between me and the door and is like, please step to the side. And I'm like, okay. Step to the side. He lets everyone else come in. He turns to me and goes, what's your name? He was like, I don't have you here on the docket. Like, are you sure you're in the right courtroom? Like, are you the defendant? And I was like, no, you know, I am the attorney, actually. I have never been so embarrassed in my entire life.
Unfortunately, this is an experience that Simone Yap can relate to far too well.
During my first year of law school, specifically the start of my second semester, I actually had the police called on me while I was studying at my law school. And I think the most ironic part of that, the police were called on me as I was sitting in front of a Black Lives Matter poster that the school had hung up. And it was your standard, you know, studying while Black. And for me, I just found it to be crazy. Literally in my law school, studying, applying for jobs at that very moment. I remember the exact firm that I was applying to for my 1L summer. And they were just coming up accosting me. There were no cameras in the area. There were no witnesses. And they were asking for my identification, followed me out. They were watching me until I got in my car. And for me, I was so flabbergasted. I was so stunned to experience that. It was a lot emotionally, physically, mentally, and still having to get acclimated to the hardship of law school. It is not easy. It is a different type of academic rigor that you have not experienced until you experience it. And also having to sit in classrooms where you're having your race debated over, like it's the topic of the day, and people not understanding different cultural nuances and racial and ethnic nuances as well, but also economic, and having to explain it every single day. And so all of that combined, it's like, oh my goodness, I feel like I'm about to lose my mind or lose my emotional sanity because I'm going through all of these things, and to have no support, I'm saying, you know what? I don't need their support. I'm going to get through it regardless. So coming up with a strategy of how I'm going to address this issue, talking with my parents about it, and really thinking about, you know what, how am I going to implement systemic change so that this does not happen to another Black law student again?
And listen, these painful experiences of exclusion, they're part of the reason the National Black Law Student Association was determined to add its voice to calling for the full inclusion of Ketanji Brown Jackson on the nation's highest court.
We actually worked with Demand Justice to develop a day of action in Washington, D.C. for Black law students across the nation to be in D.C. for this historical and monumental moment. And so we were organizing with them, and what we did was have protests and also develop spaces for watch parties of the confirmation hearings, as well as panels of prolific attorneys, but also advocates. And while we were there, we actually had the opportunity to attend the confirmation hearings in person. And I actually have the tickets framed because it's just such, again, a significant moment in our history. And so just being in Washington, D.C. during this moment meant so much to have Black women on the left and the right of me, to have our Black men there, and also those that are gender diverse there to be a part of this moment, and knowing that the glass ceilings, they're shattered, and we're stepping literally all over these shards. And we are here, we are present.
Standing in the tradition of Constance Baker Motley and witnessing the confirmation of Justice Jackson, we asked Simone how she imagines change-making to be part of her career as a lawyer.
It starts from the moment I entered into this profession. How do I lift as I climb? How do I make sure that I'm consistently engaging in the essence of Sankofa, which is reaching back to pull forward? So really pouring into those that are coming up with me, but also after me.
For Simone, it's all part of manifesting her vision for a just and equitable world.
A just and equitable world would look like seeing Black people, period, in all of these places that we were systemically and institutionally kept out of, but also implementing positive, long-lasting change and providing more opportunities. So seeing more Black people in partnership and partner roles at these major law firms, seeing more Black judges and politicians, public defenders and prosecutors, having a reduction of a carceral state and having a reduction on the continuity of slavery-based policies. How do we make our society more accessible and equal and be loving and kind instead of Who can we get over on the next day? And who do we have to step over to get to this area?
I'm so excited to watch Simone Yap become the kind of lawyer that would undoubtedly make Constance Baker Motley proud. Mm-hmm. All right, Dorian, we've had another great deep dive, and I always appreciate you being here with me on this. And I feel like we learned all the things.
All the things, Melissa. It's so good, as always, to be with you right here on The Takeaway.
And hey, check out all of our deep dive segments. They're up at thetakeaway.org/special projects. Thanks so much for spending time with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.